All right, man. Welcome to Crow 777 Radio. This is hour one of episode 665. Jason Lindgren is with me, and Judy Gregerson joins us. On the tail of the interview we did with Jerry Marcinski, there was such a response. A lot of people have an interest in what we're about to cover. So we've asked Judy to come on, and we're once again going to talk about schizophrenia. As you should know from the Jerry Marcinski episode we did, the mainstream is still saying things like, this is clearly chemical imbalances, and clearly we need to give people chemical drugs to try to treat this. But we take a very different tack here. We recognize this as, for lack of better terms, a spiritual attack. As Judy goes along, she's a person who overcame schizophrenia. We're going to talk about her early life, then we're going to get into how she overcame this. And she will be able to tell you what she provides to others and a website when we get there. Welcome, Jason.
And a rather decent good morning before this great cold comes through.
Anything you want to throw in before I bring Judy in?
Well, this is going to be building off of everything we discussed with Jerry Marcinski, which if you've heard that episode, that was beyond interesting. And this is going to be the same.
Right. We're coming to a point where these shackles of mainstream thinking are beginning to come off. And this is a key topic, if we think in this way. To be afflicted with such a thing, I can't even imagine, as schizophrenia and some of the accounts we've heard, and then go to a professional who not only has it wrong, the way that they try to come at you is also equally unhelpful. That's a terrible situation, and why we are doubling down to cover this a bit further and hopefully give people avenues of approach to get out from under such things. Anyhow, welcome, Judy.
Hi there. Thanks for having me on.
It's a pleasure to have you, and I look forward to what we're about to do. Would you like to offer up contact or website or anything like that before we get started?
Yeah, that would be great. People can visit my website at strategiesforovercomers.com. And I have an email, which is my name, Judy Gregerson, at strategiesforovercomers.com. And I usually answer fairly quickly, and I'm happy to hear from people.
Okay. In other words, you can offer assistance or direction to people who may be suffering.
Yeah, I can. And I spend a lot of time on the phone with people listening to what's going on, explaining what I know that's pertinent to what they're dealing with, and then helping them find a direction to go, whether it's me helping them or sending them on to somebody that would be even better for them.
All right. Before we jump in here, let's balance the scale appropriately. Do you agree with the statement I made in the intro that the mainstream views schizophrenia as a chemical imbalance, I guess, in the brain, and that what we're talking about here would be better described as a spiritual attack as opposed to some chemical thing?
Yes, I do. I agree with it totally and completely, and I lived it, I know it, and I work with people now, and I see it every week, the changes that come about spiritually and the things that we can get rid of. So, yeah, I'm 100% on it.
All right, well, let's jump in and see if we can break some of the shackles of mainstream thinking that are so outdated that it's almost embarrassing. So let's get into your early life and background to set the stage here.
Okay, so I was born in the end of Long Island in a little town that was once, the New York Times labeled it, best small town in America. It was a neat little town, lots of fishing, seafood, summer sports. My dad was a Navy pilot. He was in the reserves. He had once trained the Blue Angels. And then he became a cover model. He was on the cover of Life magazine. I also modeled as a kid. I was in Life magazine. So we had this very idyllic life. We had a quality yacht. It was a boat. It was 34 feet long. And we would go all over Long Island Sound out in the ocean up to Rhode Island. We spent our summers on the water. We had our own lobster pots. So we had this great little idyllic life, except for one problem. My parents were both drinkers. And the drinking, the social drinking, which was very prevalent in the 60s, there were all the cocktail parties every weekend. People had cocktail parties and everybody was going to them. And the alcohol really took over my mother and father. My father was a very friendly, sweet alcoholic, and you'd never know he was drunk. And my mother was a vicious, nasty, horrible alcoholic. And I did not know when I was young that my dad was encouraging my mother to drink because he was having affairs on the side. So he was slowly helping her to disintegrate. So from the time that I was 8 years old, I spent most of my nights up in the middle of the night with my mother because she was crying or screaming or because she was dragging us out of the house to go find my father. And she terrorized us by driving us around drunk and almost once drove us into the creek, almost killed us. And she had been my best friend. And when I was 8 or 9, I realized she was gone. She was gone. And it was devastating to me. And it became a situation in my house. I had two sisters and a brother. My older sister left by the time I was 10. So she missed some of this later stuff. But it became an every man for himself kind of world. So I was 9 years old, and I had to figure out life for myself because my father was neglectful and my mother was out to lunch on booze. And so I had to figure it out for myself. And it led to me to begin binge drinking by the time I was 12 and also a suicide attempt at 12 because I didn't know how to handle this. And I had a sister 2 years older than me who I had to take care of because she couldn't cope with this at all. So I had to take care of her and comfort her and tell her that we were going to be okay. So I became the parent in the family. I took care of my mother. I took care of my sister. By the time I was, 11, 12 years old, when I was 13, my mother went in a corner and started drinking on a Thursday or Friday. And by Monday morning, she was just about gone. And I realized she was going to die. And my father would have let her. He just let her sit there. She would have died. The alcohol would have killed her. And so I called my uncle in upstate New York and asked him to come get her. We put her in a psych hospital in upstate New York to dry her out. And she promised me when she left that she'd come back, and she never came back. I didn't find out until later that my father had forbid anyone from helping her because he wanted to divorce her and he wanted to remarry. And so from the time she was gone till I got through high school, I was a good part, early part of the years, very depressed, binge drinking. By the time I was 15, I was sleeping around people, staying out all night. I had a boyfriend that I used to hop in his tractor trailer and we'd go to Philadelphia on the weekends and nobody ever missed me. When I was 17, I met a guy that was involved in organized crime and he at one point attempted to strangle me when he was drunk. I was able to get out of that mess and got involved with him and ended up in a little bit of a mess with organized crime in that I was pulled in, I was known, and I was watched. So when I was 18, I went off to college. I went upstate to Oswego, New York College, which was as far as I could go. I picked a college by picking the furthest place away from me that I could find and went there not knowing what I was going to study, what I was going to do. I just had to get away. So I got away. So I got up to college, and like I told you earlier, in my hometown, there was no cable. When I was a kid, there was no internet. We only had three channels, two coming out of Connecticut and one coming out of New York on the TV. So culture, pop culture hadn't caught up with us yet there. So in high school, and that was, I left high school in 1970. I had not had any influence with drugs. I had never listened to an FM station on the radio. So the music was, rock music was, the good rock music was non-existent in my life. So I go to college and I find this other whole world that existed outside my world.
The counterculture.
Yeah. And I hadn't known anything about it. And it was a free-for-all. It was do whatever you want to do. It was free love, sleep with whoever you want to sleep with, do whatever you want to do. Do all the drugs that you can, drink as much as you can. And so I jumped into that world. But by then, I didn't really have an identity. I'd never really built an identity. I had no idea who I was. I had no idea where I was going. I had dreams. I had dreams of things I wanted to do. I wanted to be a writer, which I now am. I published 5 books. I wanted to work in advertising, which I've done in the past, and marketing, which I've done. I worked as a marketing manager. So I had dreams, but I had no identity. And so I was looking for someone to give me an identity. And I found this guy, Jim. And Jim was a Vietnam veteran. There were a lot of Vietnam veterans that come back from the war, and they were such damaged people. And Jim got me into doing acid. I did tons of LSD and some mescaline. And we were doing that all the time. My girlfriend Sherry and I would do LSD, and we would run around campus together and have our hallucinations. And we would actually have the same hallucinations at the same time. And I think back now, I understand why. And we would find portals. We'd be walking around campus and we'd see portals, which were big, round, open doors, and we'd jump through them. And there was never much on the other side, but it was just, we knew it was a portal of some sort. We were going through them. And I went through some rejection because I was trying so hard to find a guy that I could identify with or whose identity I could absorb, because I had no identity of my own. I was tremendously insecure. I had no family backup. My dad, when I was 18 and I left, my dad said, "So long, you're 18, you're on your own. Basically, good luck. We hope you make it." My mother was a drunk. She was living in Ithaca, New York. She was of no help. My brother and sisters had scattered, and they weren't much help, other than my older sister who tried, but I disliked her intensely because she was a very angry person from what had happened in our home. And so I could not really communicate with her all that well. So I went through some rejection with this fellow in college and went out and got drunk and then went home and slipped my wrists. I didn't want to live. I didn't know how to live. And got involved in the counseling world there on campus and kind of patched that up and went on. But I began to feel very, I would say, alienated. I was trying very hard to hold on to the culture that I was living in on campus, and I loved my friends, and we had a great group of people, and I was trying to hold on and to find, and that was my identity. You know, I became a freak.
So let me jump in here. In the interview we did with Jerry Marzynski, I brought up, when I was doing the research for that episode, I found some medical professionals who did not go along with mainstream ideas, who put forward the idea that all drug addiction and alcohol addiction is related to the same influences that cause things like schizophrenia. And I've heard you mention a number of times now that you lacked identity and looked for people around you to fill that identity. Do you think the early alcoholism in your house and the later drug addiction or drug usage, maybe at this point in your life, contributed to the onset of schizophrenia?
Yeah, I would explain it this way to you. When you're a child and when you go through severe trials like that, severe trauma, it shatters you. It shatters your soul. And I've been learning a lot more about shattered souls recently because I'm dealing with a lot of people with shattered souls. It's like when you go through trauma or a difficult time, if you've been through some in your life, you actually feel shattered. You feel like you're shattered, you can't find the pieces, and souls do shatter. And so you're looking to put back what was lost. I had an identity of some sort before my mother became a drunk. I had a wonderful life, and it was all shattered. And so that was gone. And I had friends around me who lived in wonderful homes. They had great parents. Their parents were supportive and loved them. They were normal people. And I had lost all of that. That was stolen from me. So I had nothing that I belonged to. I had nothing that I belonged to. I had nothing that had any lasting value to me because it had all been shattered and broken. And then when my mother left, she was the closest person to me in my life. That shattered me again.
It sounds like when you're saying you were looking for an identity, it was almost an open invitation to what might be out there.
I was willing to let in anything that would make me feel alive and real and important. That's why I got involved with organized crime, because it was a thrill. It made me feel like I was somebody. I mean, that's pretty crazy at 17 to get involved in that stuff. And even when I went to college, there was a daughter of a large mafia head there. She was best friends with my best friend. There was a mafia presence in my college, which makes a lot of sense of why when I was in college, they bothered me and watched me and picked on me in some ways. So yeah, I was looking for something to fill the emptiness. I was empty. I was broken. And I was still, in a lot of ways, I was still a very strong person. And I remember one of the counselors telling me, she said, "You're one of the few people I've ever met in my life who is extremely, totally loyal to yourself." And she said, "That's going to save you." That's what she told me after I slipped my wrist. She goes, "You are loyal to yourself. Most people aren't that loyal. It will save you." And I didn't understand what she meant, but I look back now and realize that I was determined to find a life, but I just took a whole lot of bad paths to get to the right place. And so drugs are an open door. I mean, it's an invitation. especially, and I'm sure Jerry told you this, especially meth. Meth is just an open invitation.
We actually talked about that, Judy, just by chance. I'm 10 years behind you. I would have been the class of 82 in high school had I remained in high school. I left high school in the ninth grade because I couldn't stand school. But where I grew up in East County, San Diego, is where the Hell's Angels introduced crystal meth. And it became epidemic to the point where in the 1980s, you could go into a place like El Cajon and lights were on every street all night. And what I said to Jerry Marzinski is meth is inherently evil. And to say that is one thing, and everybody who's aware of that part of drug culture knows that what meth is has changed. But even though it has changed, it has remained evil through that whole thing. But to put a fine point on what you're saying is, I think the word you used is that drug usage at that level is an open door for spiritual attacks. And I also heard you talk about jumping through portals. And I've heard others say that is also an open door for spiritual attacks. Do you agree with that?
Yeah, I agree with it totally. And it was interesting because college was a place that was full of portals. And I'd never experienced that before. And so I thought that I was searching for God. I really was. I'd been searching for God since I was 3 years old. When I was 3 years old, I used to go in the front yard and pray and ask God to send angels to help me. Why at 3 years old I was asking for help, I don't remember what happened then. Well, I do remember. I found out later I'd been sexually molested when I was like 2 and a half. So at 3 a.m. begging God for help and I'm searching for him. So when I got to college, I thought, well, maybe this is it. Maybe God is in LSD. Maybe God is in pot. I should smoke pot and you get high and you have a blast and you have this wonderful time with your friends and you laugh and you think you've found something good. And so with acid, I'd have these crazy trips. My friend Sherry and I, we laughed. We had so much fun. I thought I'd found God. And I remember going to a bar. You know, we went to the bar every weekend, every Wednesday night to drink, you know, beer on tap. And I remember telling somebody, you're missing out. You haven't tried acid. I found God. I really thought I'd found God.
That was a big part of the branding of the counterculture. The idea that somehow this drug use could open your mind was one of the big taglines. And the idea of finding God was one of the taglines. And also at that point, and people probably find this outlandish now, there was the idea that many of the harder drugs were not addictive. Like when cocaine first came around, which was later, it was billed as non-addictive. But let's jump in where the rubber meets the road. Jason, do you want to add anything? I'm going to ask her to get into the onset of schizophrenia unless you'd like to add something here.
Well, what she was saying reminds me of the line, turn off your mind, relax, and float downstream.
Yeah, that's what it was about. And turning off your mind is another open door.
It's funny, in the bullets that you provided so we didn't miss things, when you put the bullet growing up in the 60s, in the parentheses that describe it, it says music, culture, Van Morrison, LSD, and counterculture influence. And it's funny, but I get exactly what you're illustrating within those parentheses. And I'm 10 years your junior, but let's jump in here and talk about the onset of schizophrenia. And let's include anything that you think contributed or maybe mistakes that you made that think got you in this position, this kind of approach.
Okay. So it started, I think let me say this. These demons who cause schizophrenia groom you. And I can look back at my life and I can see how I was groomed. They groom your thinking. They groom your identity. They groom your affirmations, whatever you say about yourself. And for me, it was, I'm a piece of junk. Nobody loves me. I'm ugly. I'll never be anything. I'm not worthy. I'm no good. They groom me from an early age. So every step along the way, they groom me a little bit more. And it was a journey that I took. So the first bad step was I had a bad acid trip. And because I was involved with organized crime and they were threatening me when I was a freshman in college, they were threatening me to keep my mouth shut or else. And I had a bad acid trip where I developed paranoia. I went into severe paranoia and I thought they were going to come and kill me And I decided, when I came down, I decided I'm not taking drugs anymore. I'm not taking acid anymore because, and during that acid trip, I actually felt my mind snap. I could hear my mind snap. And so I was convinced when I came off that trip that something in me had snapped. My mind had snapped. I didn't know what that meant, and I didn't know how it was going to play out. Well, then in that year, May of that year, I went to the Washington, D.C. May Day March in 71. And that was the largest protest, anti-government protest ever in the United States. And I ended up getting maced and arrested with 20,000 other people. Ended up in the D.C. jail in the courtyard with Benjamin Spock and I forget who else was there, but tons of people. And it was there that I realized that I had been trying to build this identity. Now that I'm a, quote, freak and I'm doing protests. But when I got arrested, what I found out was the people who had put the protest together, the people who had given their speeches in Georgetown had left the city before Nixon called out the tanks and the riot troops. They got out of the way, and I realized, oh, I'm just human fodder for them. They're just using me. I figured that out and decided I would never again join another group because I realized those protests were managed and planned and funded, and I figured it out, and I went home, and I was done with them. So now I was done with LSD. I'm done with being a protester. I went home for the summer, and I started having dissociative episodes. I was working as a waitress. I'd be walking along, carrying a tray, and I'd black out, not fall on the ground, black out, but just my mind would black out and go blank. I didn't know who I was. I didn't know where I was. I didn't know what I was doing. And I honestly don't remember how long they lasted. It couldn't have been long because I continued to work as a waitress. So it must have been for like 5 seconds or so.
Did you attribute that to the LSD use?
Yes, I thought that was a part of my mind snapping. I had had, since I was 12 or 13, a tremendous fear of going crazy because I watched my mother go crazy. I watched her disintegrate. And it's an awful thing for a child to have to watch a parent disintegrate till there's nothing left of him. And then I watched my father destroy her. So I was convinced, and this is what I talk about, they groom you along the way. I watched that, and I was convinced I would go crazy. So when I had those dissociative episodes, I thought, okay, craziness has reached me, found me. I'm on the way down. And I didn't know how to fight it. I didn't know who to talk to. I didn't know what to do. So summer was over. I went back to college. When I got back to college, there was a guy that I was very much in love with. And he wasn't so much in love with me. And I was very clingy. And he actually quit college and went home the semester. Partially, I think, to get away from me. And that devastated me. So I went one night. I had Valium. I actually had gone into town to a doctor to get Valium because I'd planned to kill myself. And at that point, they would give them out. They'd give you 30 or 60 of them. It was no big deal. You know, Valium was like, eh, everybody can have Valium. So I had a bottle of them and I took them. And as I was beginning to fade away, I heard a voice. And it said, pick up the phone and call somebody now because you're going to die. And if you die, you're going to hell. And that's not my plan for you.
Are you describing the onset of schizophrenia right now?
I don't think so, because that voice saved me. I don't think a demon would have saved me.
Good point. Okay, go ahead.
So I picked up the phone and I called my roommate and told her what I'd done. And the next thing I know, I wake up in the hospital with tubes down my throat. And I'm screaming and kicking and pulling tubes out and hitting nurses because I was pissed off at that point that I was still alive. And it was soon after that. Of course, that suicide attempt gave me a one-way ticket to the mental health system. And during that time, within probably a week of that time, I was sitting in the student union. My life had collapsed. I was going into the mental health system. That to me meant that I was going into an asylum. And on campus, people really believed once you disintegrated from drugs, if they sent you to Marcy Hospital, or I think it was Marcy, it was the hospital in upstate New York where I was, you were never coming out. So here my life had ended again. It shattered one more time. So I was sitting in the student union. And I saw this woman, this tall, thin woman coming towards me. And I'm like, oh, crap. And I sit down and talk to me. She did. She was really, really bold. She worked for Campus Crusade for Christ. She was a campus missionary. And she started preaching the gospel to me, telling me I'm a sinner and I need to repent. And Jesus died for my sins. And so she showed me a picture of this two cliffs and a gulf in between. And I need to accept Christ. And to know God and have my sins forgiven. And it made me so angry.
It was repulsive.
Oh my gosh, I wanted to hit her, because demons hate the name of Jesus. They hate it. They don't want you listening to any of that stuff. And she gave me a booklet which showed me, you know, what a lousy sinner I was. That's how I interpret it. And wrote her name and her phone number on the back. And I got up and I ran. I ran back to my dorm because it so infuriated, it so scared me. And I thought, how dare she? How dare she? And she also told me Jesus had a wonderful plan for my life. And that really pissed me off. Because I thought, what do you know? What do you know about my life? What's this wonderful plan? This plan isn't going so good so far.
Is this pre-schizophrenia that you're describing this?
Yeah, probably within a week. Okay. I was going there. I was dissociative, on and off. I was depressed. I was well on my way.
But influenced, clearly, by the anger you're attributing to influence.
Yeah. So okay. I went back to my dorm, and I'm lying on my bed, and I'm just pissed off, and I'm upset, and I'm depressed. And it hit me. I had a revelation that what she told me was true. And I didn't have any way to prove it, but I knew it. I just knew it. I knew that what she had told me was true. I knew that Jesus was alive. I just knew it as I knew that I had a hand on, because I could see it. So I called her that night and told her I knew that what she told me was true. And so she prayed with me so I could become a Christian. And I went to bed that night thinking, okay, I'm going to wake up in the morning and God's going to make me okay. I'm going to be okay in the morning. And I woke up the next morning and I was not okay. So my journey began with the mental health system. I actually had to sit before a panel of psychiatrists to prove to them that I wasn't going to kill myself. And if they didn't believe that, they were going to put me in Marcy for God knows how long at that point. That time it was for life until they set all the prisoners free in the mid-late 70s. They let them all out of the psych wards. And so I sat before a panel. They told me that I could stay on the outside. I went to a specific psychiatrist. And the first thing he asked me was, are you homicidal or are you suicidal? And he told me I was schizophrenic, and he gave me medicine for schizophrenia, for depression, and then a pill for side effects.
Did you consider yourself schizophrenic before he said that?
Well, let me go back, because I jumped ahead. So let me go back. Because there was a moment where schizophrenia jumped in and I missed it.
So you know the moment you became afflicted.
Oh yeah, I remember it.
Okay, let's hear that.
In between that week, between accepting Christ and going to the psychiatrist before the panel, I was lying in my room one day smoking pot and just lying there higher than a kite, and I could see in my mind a portal. And it was a big door, big, thick door, like you would see on old castles in Europe. I mean, a big, thick door, heavy door. It's probably 4 or 5 inches thick. And it was calling to me. And I knew it was a portal because I'd been through portals on acid before. And so I thought, well, I'll go through that. That'll be fun. Let's see what's on the other side. So in my mind, I walked to the door. I opened the door up. I walked in, and the area was kind of a medium gray, a light gray. There was nothing to see but this light gray fog. And I shut the door behind me, and I'm just standing there going, okay, well, this is odd. And then I thought, well, there's nothing here. So I grabbed the door handle to get out, and the door was locked. And I couldn't get out. And then the voices started. There were four of them. And they lived in the four corners of my mind. That's where they went. And they began to torment me. He told me that I was worth nothing, that I was dead, my life was over, I was going to die, I was going to end up in a psych ward, nobody wanted me, I was ugly. And then they would argue with each other about how crazy I was.
The voices that you were hearing, did it sound like your voice? Did they have their own unique voice, or did each voice have its own unique voice?
There were four, there were three what I identified as men and one woman. They did not sound like my voice. I named the woman Nancy. I don't remember what I named the men. I gave them names because they were very distinct. And they had distinct personalities.
And they moved in and stayed at that point. When you walked through that door, that's how you became connected to this. And they just, from that point forward, they remained with you.
Yes. And there have been studies now on young men who become schizophrenic. And the studies have shown that most of them become schizophrenic are big users of marijuana. And when I saw that study, I said, well, I can tell you why, because you open that door. And the thing about going through that door was that they gave me an invitation and I went willingly. I said, okay, here I come. And I went. So I just opened myself up to whatever was going to come after me. And it came. And it stayed with me and it tormented me. And not only were there voices, there was a presence. And the presence was dark and it was evil and it was heavy and it was crushing and it was suffocating and it was paralyzing.
Were you able to comprehend that at that point you were schizophrenic, or were you just completely discombobulated and searching?
I was trying to understand it. My roommate came home that day, and here's what happened that day. When they took over, my mind went into another dimension. So I was living in the real world, but my mind was living in that dimension. And I was lost in there, and there was no way out. So when my roommate came home that afternoon and took one look at me and said, what's wrong? And I said, I'm gone. She said, what do you mean you're gone? I said, I'm gone. I'm not here anymore. She said, where are you? And I said, I don't know. It's very gray. I don't know where I am. She called the administration and they sent over one of the deans because she was scared to death what had happened to me. They didn't know. And I actually had she was a really nice dean. She became a good friend. So that's when I had already had an appointment in psychiatry. So I go to the psychiatrist and then I thought that my mind had shattered and I'd finally gone crazy. And that these four voices talking to me were parts of myself, but I couldn't understand why parts of myself would be punishing me and tormenting me.
Okay, now it starts to fit. So you've brought us up. They're bringing you in to see the psychiatrist and he informs you at that point that you're schizophrenic.
Yeah. And wants to know if I'm suicidal or homicidal, which is very interesting because apparently schizophrenics are one or the other. If they're suicidal, they're not homicidal. If they're homicidal, they're not suicidal. But every appointment I went to, that's the first question I got asked. Are you suicidal or homicidal? Because they watch you at that time, you know, that county mental health system was watching very closely.
Isn't that kind of a tell that the mainstream, who to this day tells you that you're dealing with a chemical imbalance, asks those two questions, which clearly indicate that it can't possibly be a chemical imbalance because it seems to be uniform across everybody they treat.
Yeah. And, you know, there's different kinds of schizophrenics. There are schizophrenics like me who were dissociative, and I was so terrified. And being in that mindset, I could look over a cliff. I could see a cliff, and I realized I could go a step deeper and a step deeper. And I could see at the bottom of that hole that I was in was being catatonic. I mean, that's what they showed me. I don't know how true that is, but I believed it. And so my whole life was spent trying to hold my ground. And for me, holding my ground some days meant being dissociated and just holding on with everything I had, just not to go more crazy, because I could see I could go more crazy. I could be deeper into this, and I knew they wanted to take me deeper. And so along with that came the presence, the fear, the paranoia. And they told me, they're going to come get you. And I'm like, who's going to come get me? I'm thinking, they never told me who was going to come get me, but they said, you've screwed up. They're going to come take you away. They're going to come get you. So when the phone rang, I would jump. I thought, that's it. That's the phone call. These are the people coming. Or somebody knocked on the door. Somebody was coming to get me. But at the same time, I was in college and I had to act normal. So you take a schizophrenic who's trying to act normal and you have a very weird person because you're not functioning in the real world other than to do what you think looks normal. Like you're going through what you think the paces are to get through a day you're doing. And it's very bizarre. There are people that I knew back then who, if I called them today, wouldn't talk to me, because I so freaked them out by being so crazy and the things I said and did. And these voices would tell me, you know, they would control me and they would manipulate me. When they didn't want me to eat, they'd tell me if I went to the dining hall that the dining hall was going to blow up and I was going to be killed. If I went to the dining hall, when they didn't say that, brought food back to my room, they told me if I ate it, that the dorm was going to blow up. So they did that kind of stuff with me. At one point, they told me to kill one of my friends. And he was a guy that had gotten me into acid. And they said to me, there he is. He's the one that ruined you. He's the one that broke your brain. He's the one that made you crazy. And there was a big, heavy lamp there. And they said, pick it up and crush his brain in. And I had enough wherewithal. I was not homicidal, but they were testing me to see if they could push me to that level, to turn me into a murderer. And I had enough wherewithal. I loved people. I'd always loved people. I couldn't bear the idea of killing someone. It didn't bother me to try to kill myself. I was all fine with that. But to hurt somebody else, no, I wouldn't do it.
Were these all the same voices that you mentioned earlier? Were they the same personalities, I guess you could say?
Yeah, it was. But as the drugs took hold on me, first of all, the drugs made me almost blind for nearly a week.
What drugs?
The psychotropic drugs that they put me on.
So the mainstream gave you a prescription for psychotropic drugs.
Yeah.
And so what Jerry Marzinski had said is that many of those drugs basically just dope you down so much that you're not functional.
It's like taking an elephant tranquilizer, I think. But they also, the side effects, it says, can give you blurry eyesight. What they didn't tell me was you're not going to be able to see much for a week. When I called my psychiatrist, I said, I can't see. I just see kind of blurred objects, but not enough to be able to negotiate life. And he said, oh, that'll go away. It's just a side effect. I mean, it was like, oh, well. Now, I'll tell you something. And I wrote a book about this called The Terrible Years. It's on Amazon. I tell the whole story in there for people who want to dig deeper into it. These psychiatrists have no clue how they are traumatizing people by, number one, telling them, this is forever. This is caused by a chemical imbalance. And so you have to take these drugs. It's a death sentence. That's what they're giving you. They don't even realize they're doing it. They're basically saying your life is over. It's dead. You're never going to get your life back. And so they are traumatizing you. Then they give you the drugs. Those turn you into a noodle. You lose, I think they in some way steal your soul. And it's interesting because I talked to a guy who was a missionary in Africa, and he dealt a lot with witch doctors. And you know what they do when the witch doctors go to make their bargains with the spirits? They take the drugs like ayahuasca, right? He said, but they know that those demons that they're going into in the second heaven, they know how dangerous and slippery and nasty and cunning they are. He says they want to get out as quickly as they can. And he said, so they take antipsychotic drugs to get out of the second heaven, to get out away. I don't know why. I don't know why that works. I would think that it would almost do the opposite, because taking them for me, what it did was it turned the voices into my thoughts. It took me out of that realm of hearing voices. Now they were just thoughts. But the presence was still there.
So a couple of things. You mentioned that your mind had split, and you kind of implied that the voices were fractions of your own mind. But you've also said that you're schizophrenic now, and we've determined that that's a spiritual attack. Is it a combination of both of those things?
I think that the splitting and the fracturing of the personality is another open door. And from what I've read and studied, that when a soul fragments, demons put themselves in the places that are broken off. And they begin to steer, and they begin to guide, and they begin to control in those areas. So they load up. They load in. I had four that I knew of. I could have had 100. I don't know.
You've also mentioned the term second heaven. Is that analogous to like the astral plane, or what do you mean by second heaven?
Well, the Bible describes that there are three heavens. One is earth. Second heaven is where demons and spirits live. Not the good guys, the bad guys. The third heaven is where God and his angels live. So the second heaven, if you listen to some testimonies of people who are into witchcraft, whatever, they'll talk about going to the second heaven to get their orders. That is the dimension. It's a dimension. It's a spiritual dimension where those entities live. So that is the dimension that was playing upon my mind. That was in some way they were bringing into my mind, which is their world, their feelings, their anger. I mean, they're hateful creatures.
Oh, I asked Jerry about this. I asked him if the voices that are afflicting with schizophrenia are 100% negative, and he says darn near 100% negative. Do you share that view?
In my experience, yes.
All the way to death negative?
Well, yeah, because what you come to understand when these voices come, you come to understand that the end of all this is you're going to die. I knew after about a year of this that the end of that for me was going to be death. Either they were going to kill me somehow or I was going to kill myself, which they would drive me to. But I knew that my life was over. It was only a matter of time before either I took my life or they did somehow find a way to do that through an accident, through whatever.
So if it's a nearly 100% negative across almost all people who suffer from schizophrenia, do you have an idea of why they are working so hard and nonstop to generate negative emotions? Are they harvesting that energy? Is there some other reason?
A lot of people think they're harvesting that energy. My take on it, and in my perspective is a biblical perspective of what God says about them. They come to kill, steal, and destroy. So they came, they stole my identity, what little there was left. They stole my future. And my understanding of demons is there's two things that they want to kill. The first one is your identity and then your destiny. And when they kill your identity, then you're on the road to losing your future. I knew that it was not going to end well, and I believed I was not going to live long. A couple of years, maybe, I would make it.
When an outsider looks in at this, logically, it seems just bizarre because a parasite typically doesn't take the host all the way to death or they lose their host.
Ah, but they gain more because they killed somebody, then they've got a family that's broken. Now they've got a new way to go.
Oh, so what you're suggesting here is when they've done so much damage to the initial victim, they've already been preparing for the family that's around them.
Oh, yeah. And my family was so broken anyway. My sister was broken. My brother was broken. My mother at that point was still alive. She ended up getting murdered later in life. My dad was broken, although I don't think he realized how broken he was. We're all broken. So you add a suicide to a family like that, that has done basically nothing to help. And so they have to live with that. I can't imagine what that's like to realize, oh, I could have done something and I didn't. I just really didn't want to be bothered.
There's another point here that I think is crucial, particularly if we look at the world around us. In the 1960s and the 70s, pot was ubiquitous. It was non-addictive. It was, why is this even illegal? It's less damaging than things like alcohol. It's almost like aspirin. That was the view of pot. We all know how much more potent it's got. But if I wanted pot back then, I had to secretly find the dealer. And there were places where secretly the dealer would be. Well, now we're at a place where the dealer's like at a CVS. It's a storefront. I can go there. And the idea behind pot, even to this day, is it's innocuous. It's benign. It's so non-addictive and so non-problematic. Well, first of all, I can tell you for a fact, pot is not non-addictive. It just isn't. My whole life, I have known people who smoke pot. For more than half of my life, I smoked pot until I got out of the Marine Corps. And I know plenty of people who can't stop. And if they do, they can't sleep. They're irritable. It's the same signs of addiction. But it's being legalized now everywhere. And in your mind, or what I've heard you say, is that the pot was a major contributing factor. As a matter of fact, I've heard you say that the drugs in general were a major contributing factor.
Yeah, they were the tipping point for me because they were open doors. I mean, there were a lot of other open doors in my life. Trauma is an open door. And I had so much trauma. That's an open door. But the drugs were the tipping point. They began to send me over the edge and to weaken me and to weaken me and to weaken me and weaken me. Like, I talk to schizophrenics now, a lot of them. It doesn't just happen one day. Schizophrenia starts when you're a kid. I have one woman I talked to, she's 3 years old. She had voices talking to her. She's 3 years old. And they were entertaining to her. And they drew her in. So it's not a bing bang, one day it just happens. They build and build and build. And they grew me along the way. And they stole my identity from the time I was 8 or 9 all the way till I became schizophrenic. And then they weren't giving it back. And I have to tell you that after I got rid of them, after I was not schizophrenic anymore, I had rebuilt my identity. I had to rebuild my mind because everything they told me for 4 years was negative, and I believed it. So when they were gone, all those thoughts and those patterns were still in my mind. Thank God for brain plasticity, that you can rebuild your mind. You can break down those strongholds.
From the onset, because you remember when schizophrenia occurred,
mm-hmm.
was the idea being projected to you that those are others in your mind or that those are you? What was being communicated to get you to believe that it was part of you doing this or that it was someone else?
At first, I was so confused. Oh my God. It brings so much confusion. And you try to figure this out. There's no figuring this out in your mind. You can't fix this. But because they were distinct voices, I came to the conclusion that they were parts of me that were beating me up, that were mad at me. It's the only thing I could understand, but they were distinct people. They were not me. So I was confused. I didn't know what to think. But when I got on the drugs and they morphed from voices into thoughts and feelings and moods. They would impress a mood upon me. I'd wake up and the mood would be, life is not worth living, just die, lay in this bed and die. And I would lay in that bed to die. You know, so even to this day, I'm so sensitive to any mood I get. I check my mood so fast. Because moods, if you follow them, can take you places you don't need to go. I wouldn't have known that if I wasn't schizophrenic, that I could check them at the door and say, sorry, I'm not going with that mood today. Get out of here. I'm going to choose my own mood for the day. So they became like my own thoughts. And they weren't screaming at me anymore, but there was such torment in the fear and the paranoia and the presence I felt. The presence was paralyzing, absolutely emotionally paralyzing. And the other thing that happened was, when the voices were loud and when the presence, and there's another thing that I helped a guy with who he called it chaos brain. There's a part of schizophrenia where you get chaos brain, which is indistinguishable noise. It's just noise. It's just clutter in your brain kind of screaming at you. And it's not really a person. It's just noise. And I would get that noise and I'd go to the student union and it was so loud, I couldn't hear the people around me. It was so loud in my head. Now, they've done brain scans on schizophrenics, and they've noticed that the auditory part of the brain is lit up like a Christmas tree. And I can tell you why, because it's on fire when you're schizophrenic. That noise, that auditory part, they take control of it. And there were times I couldn't hear people talking. I would just sit there and pretend like I heard them and nod my head because I couldn't turn the noise off.
We're coming to the top of the first hour. There's a couple things I want to get in before we break, but how soon after the onset were you aware that the voices had access to everything you knew? Everywhere you've ever been, everything you've ever thought, how quickly were you able to be aware that the voices had access to everything?
I didn't know. I did not know until I got free. I did not know until somebody told me they were demons and how to get rid of them. I had no clue.
All right. So before we break for the first hour, for the benefit of people listening, I will remind everybody that Judy freed herself from this, whether you want to call that recovery, whatever you want to call it, because there was a spiritual turning point. And what I'm about to say is critical. This could be applied, I think, to any culture. As a matter of fact, when we spoke with Jerry Marzinski, we were told that people who follow the Quran actually refer to them. I think we were told it was jinn. I hope I have that right, but they actually have provisions which seem to be effective to deal with it. And I will remind everybody, if you ever know someone who is an alcoholic or if you've had experience with Alcoholics Anonymous, the first premise is that you need a higher power. The idea being that there needs to be a spiritual foundation for you to build upon. Now, in Judy's case, she became a Christian. When we talked to Jerry Marzinski, there were some like mic drop moments, like when he talked about Psalm 23. To me, that was a mic drop moment. It's like you just stop dead in your tracks to try to put together what you've just heard. So with just a couple minutes left in the first hour, you have a spiritual turning point. Can you just briefly outline that before we take the break to come back for hour two?
The turning point was after I'd gone through 6 months or more of counseling with someone who helped me to deal with all my trauma, which was a horrible 6 months because it's like opening wounds. When I went through that and I went through a period of forgiving, because I was a hateful person by that time. I hated everybody, hated my family. I hated what happened in my life. I had to learn how to forgive. After I went through that, that was about 6 months and it was grueling. I met a preacher from Philadelphia who I started telling my story, and she said to me, I was telling her going on, and she put her hand up. She said, just stop. She said, Judy, they're demons, and I'll tell you how to get rid of them. And she told me how to get rid of them. And then I went into that battle, which was about a 3-month battle of getting rid of them. And then they were gone.
Did you believe her when she told it to you at first, or did you have to go prove to yourself?
My thought was like, oh, it's that easy. Okay, it's that easy. This is like the magic wand. Okay, I just do this and these are going to go away. And I found it laughable. But at the same time, I had read enough of the Bible to know that demons existed. And I was desperate enough that she'd give me a little pocket promise book, had Bible promises in it. She said, when they come, you know, you tell them they don't have any power over you. They got to go, and you read scripture to them. And I carried that book with me for a while. I was scared to death to try it because I was so afraid of being disappointed, finding out, no, there's no answer. And finally, I did do what she told me to do. They left.
All right. Last question for the first hour, unless Jason wants to add something. Is it your current point of view that a spiritual foundation is going to be required for anyone who wants to overcome this?
Yes. That's the hardest thing I have to tell people, because a lot of people want a method. They don't want a man. And the answer is, for me, is Jesus. And I see that with people I work with. It's Jesus. A lot of people come, they want to get free, but they just want the method. They don't want the man. And that's the toughest thing.
One thing that strikes me is when you were describing the portal that you shouldn't have gone through, I think you laid it out very succinctly. It was an offer, and you accepted the offer. And to accept an offer, we deal with this all day long in the social engineering of this world. It is endless offers. But when you accept an offer, it's really no different than signing a contract. In your mind, you have accepted a thing. In your mind, you have opened up a door for that thing. And I think that's a critical point to make. But Jason, we're pretty much there. Is there anything you want to get in before we break for hour one?
So in hour two, if anyone's dealing with this, you'll be able to go into detail on how to deal with this, right?
Yeah. Yeah, I will.
So I think we're at a turning point in the world where what I call the shackles of mainstream thinking, they're breaking. The links of those chains are breaking all over the world. There's a new day about to dawn. And we've covered so much about the systems that are trying to take total control and install surveillance and all the things going on around us. But there is little to no doubt that there is a very different world about to emerge. And in my mind, there are many people who are going to spiritually emerge with the change that happens here. And I think it's critical to consider this, because we're leaving behind a world based on hyper-materiality. We're leaving behind a world where the very science that drives our world is two-thirds blind. And yet we're aware of a system that was not two-thirds blind. And when I say two-thirds blind, I'm referring to an older natural science that viewed everything that could be schematically broken down and thought of as body, spirit, and soul. And the vestiges of that effective system are around us every day in everything we do. And yet we're shackled to mainstream thinking that will only recognize the body, keeping society at large two-thirds blind. We're going to take a short break and come back for hour two. Hour one is available to everybody at crow777radio.com. That is crow777radio.com. Members know to log in for the full episode. They get access to all the forums and comments. They get access to the 2-hour film called Shoot the Moon, covering my past telescopic work for free. They get exclusive access to the current work I'm doing with 130-millimeter hydrogen alpha solar telescope. It's going to be a big deal because, in my view, the sun is attached to the kind of era shift that we're, I shouldn't say attached, it's like the clock that we live under. And that's why the sun is so important in my view. But we're going to take a short break. We'll be back for hour two. And I hope to see everyone logged in as a member. And again, we will have contact information for those who need help, who are seeking a path. It will be available on the website, or you can make contact with us through Rose. With that, I'd like to wish everybody a happy, healthy, and higher-minded new era, and we'll be back shortly. There it is, man. Cheers.
Belief is the enemy of knowing.